Well, the discussion tonight is on naturalism, and I can't assume that everybody's been here for all the lectures this weekend, so I'll be doing a little bit of review, but I'm also pressed for time, so I'm going to have to move quickly. And as your pastor just said, naturalism is the major Western worldview in North America, the UK, at least Northern Europe, probably a lot more in Europe. I'd say Japan, for sure, Australia, New Zealand, and maybe some places in South Africa. And it's what we recognize as the university system, but, you know, it's been politicized in recent years, not just here, but growingly and very quickly in the U.S., also in Canada, where there's a lot of prejudice against the Christian worldview. And this would be a different lecture, but it would be interesting just to throw some quotations up on the board and let you know what some of the naturalists are saying today. First of all, definition. Naturalism is the worldview that very simply, there's other details, but the most amazing sort of comment, especially for someone who can't prove this, is the assurance that naturalists think they have that there's no supernatural world. The easy way to say it is the natural world is all there is. There's nothing beyond the natural world. But almost everybody knows you can't prove naturalism. You can't prove there's no God. And so how can it be so sure of itself? Well, because it's the big guy on the block. It's the leading worldview. And as a leading worldview, they can say what they want. And very, very often, they denigrate religion. They denigrate Christianity in particular. And they love to say things like, Christianity is about faith. We're about evidence. Christianity, you have to believe, believe, believe. We use experimental evidence. And on this topic, I'm undecided sometimes whether they really know what they're saying or don't know what they're saying, but it's not true. What I just said is a flip of what's actually true, and I'm going to point that out tonight. There are many evidences for religion in general and for Christianity in particular. I'd like to argue tonight, let's say three things. First of all, there's some cracks in the naturalist foundation, and naturalists today are questioning this natural-only stance that they have. Secondly, I'll be sharing those 10 arguments with you, 4 for religion in general, and then 6 for Christianity in particular. And it's the opposite way around. You can't prove naturalism. So, yes, I mean, that might be the scientific method, but not on this philosophy. You can't prove this philosophy with scientific methods. So then I say you don't have any evidence for Christianity. You folks can judge tonight when this is over, do we have any evidence? Some of the things I'm going to share with you, you maybe never heard before. Some of this stuff is pretty new. But we live in a day and age where it is exciting to be a Christian for a lot of reasons. The top reason is always because it's true. Now, if you're a naturalist, you go, yeah, well, great. Then come on up and answer the questions if you think Christianity is so bad and you think your system's so good, let's talk. And most of the time, they're not interested. They don't give Christianity a stage. I don't know why that is. Is it because they're truly prejudiced and don't think there's any evidence? Or is it because every time they do it, generally, when evangelicals debate major naturalists, the naturalists lose, usually, hands down. And it's not just Christians who say so. Read the press. Even a lot of naturalists point out that the naturalists are not doing so well. Now, that's the theme that I could produce some quotes here for you, but I'm not going to be able to slow down and do that tonight. But a lot of the naturalists say things like this. I think of Richard Lewontin of Harvard University, a research biologist who says, we have to embrace naturalism. Why? Because we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Well, what if there's evidence, and a lot of it, for the divine foot? Sorry, we're going with naturalism. Why? Because you say so? And we're going to see some other examples of that. But more and more, naturalists themselves are recognizing that naturalism is a religion. It's not a religious religion. They don't believe in God or worship or prayer. But there is as devoted to naturalism as many religious people in the world are devoted to their religions. It's a dogma. And if you want to criticize it, you're criticizing them, and they very frequently get very bothered about that. In fact, just recently, I heard about a dialogue where a Christian asked the atheist, why are atheists so angry? And by the way, I think that goes back to this morning's message, because a lot of the doubt is emotional. And the atheist answered with a little burst of anger. We're not angry. Like, okay, thank you. All right. Here's the beginning. Let's talk about a few books, naturalists who have questioned their own cause. All right, first. Go ahead. This is a slide we added this week for another school. So I'm just going to go through this. But this is the things I just mentioned to you a moment ago. All right, let's go to the next one. Anthony Flew was a British philosopher, probably when he was alive. He died 5 years ago. He was the best-known philosophical atheist in the world. He's an Oxford grad, taught at Oxford, taught at Edinburgh, taught at Reading, taught a number of places around the world, in the U.S. and Canada and elsewhere. He wrote more defense of atheism items than anybody who ever lived in history. And yet, a few years before the end of his life, he wrote a book, an intriguing title, There Is No God, which is his story throughout his life. But he came to believe that God existed. And so, very interestingly, the secular publisher, There Is a God, How the World's Most Notorious Atheist Changed His Mind. And he says there's three very important things we can't answer from atheistic philosophy or science. He describes them in the book. And for a while, the press was just buzzing with the fact that they'd lost their first son, so to speak. And there was a lot of anger about it. In fact, I mean, someday maybe I'll tell the story, maybe I won't. But Tony and I were very good friends, and we dialogued on the resurrection three times. And he told me some things behind the scene and wrote me some letters. So I have it in writing. And he wrote me some things about the pressure that atheists put on him. But they wanted him to retract statements. They wanted him to phrase things a different way. And he sent me copies of the letters going back and forth. And so I have a little journal of the way these responses came back and forth. And it's amazing. They just couldn't take it that he was saying some of these things. All right, now he became a theist or a deist. He changed the word back and forth. He did not become a Christian, to my knowledge, although who knows what he does with the Lord alone in the last moments of his life. I don't have any reason to think that he was a Christian. I want to be clear about that. But he did know about the gospel. And his father, by the way, was an evangelical pastor, and he was raised in Cambridge area. Okay, next. Thomas Nagel's an American philosopher, a dual appointment at one of our top universities, New York University. He's got a dual appointment in philosophy and law. And he's an atheist. He stays an atheist. In fact, he's got a quotation very much like Richard Lewontin's, where he says, his view goes like this, his comment. He says, I'm an evolutionist because I can't take the alternative. Now, he didn't say we can't allow a divine foot in the door, but he said, I don't want to believe the other option. That's literally what he said. I don't want to believe the other option. So I'm going to take this option. Now, let's go back to the early comment. Naturalists are all about scientific evidence. Christians are all about faith. And what does a comment like this sound like to you when a person says, I have to go on the naturalist side because I don't like the other view. That doesn't sound like an objective scientific position to me. Look at the subtitle. Why the materialistic neo-Darwinian conception of nature is almost certainly false. That's quite a mouthful. It's quite a big statement. But this wasn't said by some self-published manuscript. It was published by Oxford University Press in 2012. It was given the name the most hated book of 2012 by some naturalists because what they said, I understand, was you can believe this if you want, Tom Nagel. You can believe this if you want. But why did you have to let the cat out of the bag? Now you've given believers some weapons, some bullets, and we didn't need those things running around. We wanted to keep this in-house, you know, that we've got some cracks in our foundation. All right, I've got a couple more here. This is from a peer-reviewed science journal, Biocomplexity. The author, Michael Denton, is a physician and a British physician, I believe. Is that right? Okay. And he wrote a book questioning Darwinism about 8 years ago. And he argues there's some issues. Now, the naturalists allow him to say this because, once again, he's one of them. He's not writing as, you know, some religious person. But he's questioning Darwinism. And then, lo and behold, in this article in 2013, he goes over to the other side, at least with regard to the issue of intelligent design, which is anathema for the naturalists. They hate the incoming data. We'll say more about this in a few minutes. But notice what he says. He says that we should be open to order and nature. Nature is uniquely suitable for life as it exists on the earth. See, if the earth is patterned, and if there's what often happens is the oceans are just the right depth, and, you know, we get information on this. This is just right, this is just right, this is just right. If there was one less gas in the atmosphere, there'd be no life here. So how do we get the situation we have today? Well, a lot of naturalists say we can't talk about those things. Michael Denton says we can. And for him to say this is huge because he's still an insider, but now he's kind of saying we have to be open to this side. By the way, the previous person, Thomas Nagel, also says we've got to be able to open to intelligent design. Anthony Flew, the first person, also says we have to be open to intelligent design. These are huge cracks in the Naturalist Foundation. Okay, next. I already talked about this article this weekend. You may recall this. This is David Brooks, who I'm told by a friend of his that at the time he wrote this article, he was not a Christian. He published this in the New York Times, which is often said to be America's most liberal newspaper, and it's called The Neuro-Buddhist. And he starts out by saying, kind of paraphrasing, oh, I'm for sure paraphrasing, but his idea is naturalism is dead. And the only ones who don't know it's dead are the naturalists, who are in power in the universities. And look at some of these comments. The cognitive revolution that's going on today is not going to end up undermining faith in God. It is going to end up challenging the Bible, but not faith in God in general. Why not? Well, I'll come back to the second. Look at the third one down. Orthodox believers are going to have to defend particular doctrines and particular biblical teachings. They're going to have to defend the idea of a personal God and why specific theologies are true guides for behavior today. Last line. We are in the middle of a scientific revolution that's going to have big cultural effects. There's a revolution going on. Now, this is his point. The two competitors for the most outstanding, let's say the leader in the worldview today, the two competitors are what he calls neuro-Buddhism. It's an Eastern view a generally Eastern religious view with some kind of a scientific experimental kicker to it, with some new scientific findings. Not the kind of proof that says Eastern religion's right, not that kind. But the kind that says things like human beings are created with what's called a God spot in their mind. And there is in human beings a longing for something beyond ourselves, something eternal, something meaningful, and something more satisfying than the workaday world on earth. Okay, that's neuro-Buddhism. The biblical worldview, as he says in the third point down, we believe doctrines that the neuro-Buddhists do not. We have specific doctrines. Now, here's a little combination of this, I mean, a comparison. If this were to be a chart, picture this. The biblical worldview, there's a God. Eastern neuro-Buddhism, either there's a God or there's a force or there's some kind of something. Biblical worldview, we pray. Eastern worldview, we pray. Or even we meditate. Meditation is totally different in the two systems, but they meditate. They might say, hey, we believe in doing good unto others, and we believe in doing good. Christians are going to say, we believe in an afterlife. And the neuro-Buddhist might say, we believe in an afterlife. Both of them might say, look at near-death experiences. But here's the difference. Eastern worldviews don't have specific doctrines like we do. They have, their views are characterized by general religiosity and things that nature shows to be true, whereas Christianity has that, plus specific doctrines. So, where do we get things like a Trinity, the Atonement, the deity of Christ? He mentions a few of them here. God is personal, because Easterners may not believe that. Where do we get our special doctrines? Now, this is interesting, because if David Brooks is not a Christian, as I've been told. Now, I was told recently that he's become a Christian. I do not know if that's true, which makes this all the more interesting. I do not know, though, if that's true. But here's the call. At the time he wrote this, if the information I received is true, he was not a Christian, and he's calling us to apologetics. He's calling us to give reasons for what we believe. When unbelievers are saying, give us reasons, what should we do? Well, I would have given the reasons anyway, but if they're asking for it, let's do it. So, what I'm going to do here is go to these two lists I told you about. I'm going to go kind of quickly through the first one because the neuro-Buddhists are pretty much willing to concede most of these things. The second list is six arguments for Christianity, and they leave us on that one. So we're going to do what David Brooks has suggested and talk about six other reasons. Let's just put the four up here. Go ahead and click those in. All right, cosmology. I used this comment the other day, but one prominent philosopher says this. Darwin tells us about the survival of the fittest. Darwin does not answer the arrival of the fittest. Survival, yes. How they got here, not so much. That's not Darwin. So, what do we do with the fact, as Tony Flew says this was the number one reason he became a theist. And he said, it's Aristotle's cosmology for you philosophers. And here's one of the main issues. Why is there something in the universe rather than nothing? Why was there something rather than nothing? C.S. Lewis says it this way. If there ever was a time when nothing existed, nothing would exist now. Think about that. If there ever was a time when nothing existed, nothing would exist now. But so much of science, especially naturalistic science, deals with something like this. Well, here we are, and I don't want to believe in God, so this must be the way it went down. Okay, it's rather a circular argument, not good by logical principles. But how did this all get here? Well, I mean, I don't know. There's different answers, but they're not strong in cosmology. And the Christian beginnings would say the universe was created by God. We can come back to that if you want. Intelligent design and fine-tuning are two different species of the ID, the debate, saying that there are signs regularly in the world, especially in the human being themselves, DNA, RNA, some very special indicators of life. And it's very difficult. There is more DNA in an amoeba, one scientist says, more DNA in amoeba than there is in information that we know about the universe beyond the Earth. Now, if the early life was this soft-bodied, some of the amoeba-type creatures, how would even the first amoeba be created or evolved with this DNA and RNA? But you can't have a creature like that without these things. But it was there. DNA is a language. That's a language. How does a language come by accident at the beginning? I remember hearing years ago a debate between some atheists and theists, and Hubert Yahki, one of the early pioneers of what we call intelligent design today. Hubert Yahki wrote an article for a secular journal, the Journal of Theoretical Biology, and he ends the article like this. He says, the warm pond scenario that there was a warm pond or a bunch of them or the whole world, and the one cell creature just came from lightning or some gathering of chemicals. He says it's a popular view, but it is unscientific. It does not happen. And those who believe that view should realize this is a religion, not science. Pretty amazing. Talked about near-death experiences this weekend. When I talk about near-death experiences, I'm not talking about nice tunnels and lights and warm feelings and, I was over there and I'm not afraid to die anymore and it's great and there's an afterlife. Those are nice stories, and they clearly affect public opinion when polls show that Westerners go against naturalistic doctrines and believe in an afterlife. One naturalist said a while back, another British naturalist said, the evidence for an afterlife is so good, we should just plain admit it and go on from there. We should be naturalists who allow an afterlife. Naturalism has no grounds for an afterlife. Next to God's existence, it's probably the most damaging thing to a naturalistic worldview. But I'm interested in near-death experiences which have evidential ramifications. People report things in a near-death state without measurable heart or brain phenomena, and we can explain that during the Q&A if you want. But while they're out, they report something that happens a ways away, and they report something that can be verified. Now, how can you report something that's verifiable when you're, as far as we can tell, with all the sophistication of modern science, you have no measurable brain or heart activity? That's very difficult. And I've been in dialogues before with naturalists where when I bring this point up, they don't even want to talk about it. Now, just think about that for a second. They don't want to talk about it. Who's looking at scientific data here? And who's the one burying their heads? Who's the one looking at scientific data and who is trying to avoid the whole discussion? Every one of these, in my estimation, every one of these has scientific data in its favor. Now, if I just stopped here and I said to the naturalists, well, look, I've given you four arguments. Why don't you give me four arguments for naturalism? I'd like to see how many they could come up with. Bertrand Russell himself said, I would never say anything so stupid as I could prove God's non-existence. Well, if you can't prove God's existence, in what sense can you be an atheist? Bertrand Russell was an atheist, but he said he could not prove God's existence. That to me is somebody who's speaking hopefully and not because of the data. All right, let's go to six indications. Let's do what David Brooks suggested in the New York Times. And let's talk about indications that Christianity is true. Now, we've done several of these this weekend, but there's some other things here that we have not. For example, recently uncovered and described miracle claims that are documented. I can think of at least four books that have come out fairly recently, a couple of them very recently, with documented healings from a medical perspective, with pre and post MRIs, CAT scans, and X-rays. So you can see the previous state, you can see the state afterwards, and it was in the presence of prayer. Sometimes while the prayer was going on. And these cases are incredible. Here's one of them. This is one of my favorites. When you ask an atheist, what do you think about miracles today? Oftentimes the most strenuous objection you get is something like this. Well, fine. If you guys want to talk about miracles, I want to see a leg that grows longer when someone prays. For some reason, they always ask for legs that grow. Something about legs that grow. All right, let me tell you one that's in that category. There's a case where a little child had a club foot, and the child was going to have surgery to be able to walk. And the doctor's there, an orthopedic surgeon, and the minister says, "Can I pray one more time?" And the surgeon says, "Sure." And the minister's praying. And the doctor says, "I cheated. I looked. I was watching during the prayer." And the doctor says, "I watched the little club foot. I watched the foot open." And needless to say, we don't need to do any surgery. Now, that's in that category of something that's shorter, becoming longer. It's a foot. But there's pre and post data. There's some others that are way wilder than these. I mean, there are stories of cancer tumors that have disappeared with pre and post tests in minutes, not over 3 months or something like that. Those things happen. They can happen naturally, but in minutes when someone's been prayed for. One book, if you're interested, one book that documents about 1,000 of these. I shouldn't say documents. One book that tells about 1,000 of these, and a number of them are documented, is a book that came out, I believe, 2011. It's by Craig Keener, K-E-E-N-E-R. It's simply called Miracles. It's published by Baker Academic. It's two volumes, 1,100 pages. And like I said, a number of them are pre and post. I can give you another example or two if you're interested during the Q&A. Double-blind prayer experiences. I don't know about other universities around the world, but I know of about a half dozen double-blind prayer studies in the U.S. And secular universities, very reputable secular universities, have done work. And on a double-blind experiment, the people who are doing the testing do not know who's being prayed for and who isn't. So you can't say, well, Bob's starting to feel better today, and Bob says, well, I must be prayed for because I feel great. Well, Bob doesn't know if he's prayed for or not. You say, well, he still could start feeling better. He could. But somebody else could be feeling worse, and they could be prayed for. So it doesn't work to say this is faith healing or something like that. But most of these double-blind prayer tests have not had good results. Most of them also have, they're politically correct. So they have praying groups either not comprised of Christians or comprised of almost no Christians. And one test with no Christian prayers, those who are doing the praying, with no Christians, if you were prayed for in this test at a major university, if medical school, if you were prayed for, you were slightly less likely to be healed than if you were not prayed for. And I don't want those folks praying for me. But there were no Christians among the numbers. Now, I want to make something really, really clear. I believe God answers prayers for unbelievers. I believe God heals unbelievers. I don't doubt those things at all. You say, well, do we see that in the Bible? But we really do. Because, in fact, many, 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 many times. And here's an example. Jesus goes into a city, and one after another, here's what the text says. Jesus goes in, and all the sick were gathered to him, and he healed all of them. That's what the text says. Now, when you go into a city, and Jesus said he came not to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance, do you think everybody who came to Jesus for healing was somehow saved or something? I mean, he was just starting to preach this message. And he didn't walk up to people and do this. You saved, brother? You are? You're healed. You're not? Please, get out of here. You are healed. No, go home. It just, the text says he healed everybody. Non-discriminately. He healed everybody. I think that's a wonderful message. So, I'm not trying to say only Christians have prayers answered. I don't think that's true. However, the three tests that I know of, the only three double-blind experiments that came out positively were tests where all those doing the praying were Orthodox Christians. And at least two of them have been published in peer-reviewed secular medical journals in our country. Now, I can get you details. If you're interested, you can look it up yourself. But these are secular peer-reviewed articles. Now, you know what? You know, your country, our country, Canada, many, many other countries, Western Europe, it's not conducive to try to be a Christian to get something published in secular journals. It's not always easy. But here's what one of these prayer studies did. The author's name is Randolph Byrd. You can check this online, B-Y-R-D, Randolph Byrd. It was published in the Southern Medical Journal in the U.S. It was done with just short of 400 cardiac patients. And here's what the praise he says, the little paragraph at the beginning where you describe your study. It says this. We monitored these patients in 26 categories, and those who were prayed for did statistically better. That's the key. You talk about scientific data. They did statistically better in 21 out of 26 categories. And then this last sentence in the praise. The result of this double-blind prayer test is consistent with prayer to the Judeo-Christian God. That was the last sentence of the praise, and it was published in a peer-reviewed secular medical journal. All right, I need to move on. When I was in grad school, if you believed Jesus was a miracle worker, you wouldn't be laughed at, but people knew, chances are, you're either an evangelical or a conservative Catholic. They're about the only ones that believe Jesus was a miracle worker. Today, virtually every critical scholar writing in the field thinks Jesus was a miracle worker. Now, what kind of a miracle worker deserves some definition? And we can talk about that if you want to. But today, even the Jesus Seminar people, those in the group that reject 80 to 90% of the so-called red letter words of Jesus, say that Jesus was a healer because the evidence indicates that he healed people. Now, I'm going to go down a little bit further here, but notice how many things are true about Jesus. It centers on Jesus. Next. In the 70s, virtually nobody believed Jesus predicted his resurrection ahead of time. Today, an article was published a few years ago in one of the top historical Jesus journals, and it said six reasons, historical reasons, done by historical methodology, arguing that Jesus did predict his resurrection. What does that show? You might say, well, that's a pretty small thing, right? He predicted his resurrection. It's not as big as miracles and double-blind prayer. But think about it. If Jesus was raised from the dead, somebody could always say, which is the next point, and it's the thing we've been talking about most this weekend, but if Jesus was raised from the dead, somebody could say, all right, you've got evidence. So I'll try to keep an open mind. But that one thing they can always say is, It was a freak event of nature. I know it's odd, it's crazy, it happened just one time, it's just really odd. But if Jesus predicted it ahead of time, you know what that indicates? That's a totally different category. To rise from the dead, as great as it is one thing. But to rise from the dead after you tell everybody you're going to rise from the dead means you have a worldview and you know what's going down. If you know what's going down ahead of time, that means you're a little bit different than a person about whom something happens by chance. In fact, think of it this way. If Jesus was raised from the dead and he were a mere man, he could not raise himself, right? Dead men don't rise, and dead men don't raise themselves, because they're dead. It's not complicated. So, if he were a mere man, if Jesus is raised from the dead, somebody had to act on him. He claimed the person who was going to raise him was his father, and that he was the Son of God. If Jesus predicts it ahead of time, and it's the only time in history it happened, we'll talk about that too, if Jesus is raised from the dead, and it's the only time in history it's happened, but he knew it ahead of time, that means there's a plan. That means there's a worldview. That means there's a sequence of events that are connected. And start looking at these things. He's the, according to Edwin Yamauchi, a historian who just retired a few years ago from the University of Miami of Ohio in the U.S., Yamauchi said that Jesus is the only founder of our major world religion who has miracles reported of him within a generation. He's the only one. So, let's put these things together. He does miracles of some sort. He predicts his resurrection ahead of time. Then the last two, he is resurrected, and then we have this thing we talked about last night called the Shroud of Turin, which may or may not be Jesus' burial garment. If scholars are right, some scholars, this could be a photograph of the resurrection of Jesus. Now look at the four things you have together about this man named Jesus. He does miracles. He predicted his resurrection. He was raised from the dead. And he may have left a garment behind which bears a record of his resurrection. Six categories, which I think fulfill David Brooks's requirement that Christians put up or shut up. If you want to claim your worldview is true, he says, give me some data. Here's data. Now, Christianity, you have the other four for religion in general. Six arguments for the truth of Christianity. Some of these are pretty new. The recently documented miracle claims, the double-blind prayer. And on the other ones, views have shifted just recently. You could put the shroud in the new category, too, because it's been around for centuries, but the scientific data has really only started since 1978. And it's dates after that. Seems to me that there are data for Christianity, and on the other hand, you can't prove naturalism is true. Now, if you hold the view that says we can't allow a divine foot in the door, I understand that. There is a book. I can get the title of this. It's not, usually I'm pretty good on book titles, but a book was published a few years ago on atheism, and it argues that atheists are generally atheists for other than well-reasoned evidential arguments. It says they're atheists because something has happened to them, and they're usually pretty angry. That's just something you note. I mean, look at Dawkins. You would never accuse him of being angry, would you? So you wonder, why? Why say, yeah, I might be open, but I can't allow a divine foot in the door? Or, as Nagel says, I'm going to assume naturalism because I don't like the other view. Well, I don't like naturalism, but that's not why I'm a Christian. I'm a Christian because there are good data. So, I hope this is an indication to you that naturalism may be the big boy on the block in terms of worldview. Let's go to the last slide here. There's just a couple quick thoughts. Things are occurring today. David Brooks's point is that there's a huge revolution going on right now, and naturalism may be on the way out. I think we have to be open to these supernatural trends, and I'll end with Anthony Flew's comment about why he became a theist. I had to go where the evidence leads.